welcome to the Space Coast November 14th meeting. I'd like you all to rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Today we're going to dispense with a lot of the business meetings and all the other announcements. We only have two quick announcements. One, the next President's Forum will be on the 21st of November. And for anyone else who's interested, we're opening a Greener Living Center in Vieira, which is going to also host our trade show in March. So there'll be a ribbon cutting on the 18th. Pick up a flyer on the back tables. There's going to be a big party. Everybody should have a good time. And I would like to thank Surf Pro South of West Brevard, Dana Reddington, for all the goodies that you guys are eating this morning. She was nice enough to bring that in. Thank you, Dana. We have put together quite a panel for you with regards to community living, especially liens and foreclosures, which we know has been a hot topic in our neighborhoods and all over the state. Okay, we have Congressman Bill Posey, who has brought in some people to help answer your questions. Please write your questions down on the index cards. If you can, put an email address on the bottom. If we can't get to all the questions, we'll try to answer as many as we can via email. And this way, at least you'll get some sort of answers to some of your questions anyhow. All right, so please write them down, either give them to a board member or drop them off at either one of the sign-in tables, and we'll see to it that the panel gets your questions. At this time, I would like to turn the entire presentation over to Congressman Bill Posey. Congressman?
Thank you very much. Good morning, and thank each and every one of you for joining us here today. I am Congressman Bill Posey, and I'm happy to see so many people come out to learn more about this important subject. I'm also happy to be joined by a couple of my colleagues in the Florida legislature, Representative Rich Workman, and I understand Senator Thad Altman is on his way. Harry Charles said, asked me a couple years ago to be prepared to do a forum like today on this subject, and the situation obviously didn't get any better, it just got worse. And so when FDCA's current president, Roger Kesselbach, asked me to bring together a group of experts to answer some of your questions on issues pertaining to community living, foreclosures, and insurance, I had a little bit of a premonition from Harry in the past. We have a very knowledgeable group of people here with us today to do exactly that. And I would like to take this opportunity to introduce each one of our panelists first. And after I introduce them, they'll each talk for about 5 minutes, very brief presentations if they have one, and then we'll go directly to your questions. And as Roger asked you, we have some index cards out there. If you would put your questions on an index card, then we will answer them, have a record of them, and let our various experts comment on them. Okay. To my immediate right, we have State Representative Rich Workman. Rich was first elected to the Florida House of Representatives in 2008. He is currently what we refer to as a rising star freshman of the Florida House, well-respected and hardworking. He currently serves as Vice Chairman of the Transportation Committee. He's lived in Brevard County for over 25 years. He is an advocate of small business, less government regulation, and adhering to the Constitution. Rich lives in Suntree with his wife, Tiffany, and their children, Bailey and Sophia. Thank you for being here, Representative. To my far left, we have Buzz Osley, director of the Orlando Field Office for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Mr. Osley is responsible for outreach activity to the community, and as a former mortgage broker, he brings a wealth of information about current troubles facing many homeowners. We've had two other forums like this, and Buzz is a big hit at both those, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing him today as well. To my immediate left, we have Roy Bush with the Consumer Credit Counseling Industry. Mr. Bush is a certified credit counselor. He has been with the Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Brevard since 2001 and recently completed in June of this year the NeighborWorks America Foreclosure Intervention Training Program. So thank you for joining us today, Roy. At the far end of the table, we have Paul Ween, managing partner of Ween and Malchow. He is not a stranger to you. He has been your advocate for over a decade. Mr. Ween has a broad spectrum of practical legal experience, from commercial transaction work to civil litigation, from bankruptcy to representation of community associations like yours. He was also appointed by the Florida Senate President to serve on the Advisory Council of Condominiums. And with us for the first time, we have Erin Zebel, an attorney with the same firm as Pauline. She has a knowledge of residential closings and residential mortgage foreclosures law that she is going to share with us today. So with that, can we thank our panelists one more time, and we will... we may be joined as we move along by Senator Altman. He was planning to be with us today, but there's been a little bit of a glitch. So hopefully he'll join us before we're finished. But Mr. Ween, would you like to kick it off?
Good morning, everyone. A pleasure to be here. It's better to be here today than where I was last week. My wife works for a charity called Give Kids the World, and she decided to have their first annual fun run, and I, of course, said I would participate, good trooper that I am. And I listened to her, and I'm afflicted with a literal mind, so when she told me the course was three times around the place where she works, I went and did this, and when I saw the finish line after two and a half times, I said, something's wrong. Somebody handed me a bottle of water. I turned around and went around one more time. And in doing so, missed the closing ceremonies because I did more than I was supposed to. Sunday night, I went to the cardiologist with chest pains. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Just one point, because we're going to do a lot of questions. I guess the one thing that I'd like to focus on as an initial point is this. When you're having a lot of foreclosures going on in your property, be they mortgage or lien foreclosures, you have rights under Florida law that may allow you to use a unit that is in foreclosure to make some income, to rent it out and make some income. That becomes very difficult if the people who are in the unit are going to strip the unit or otherwise sabotage it. I've seen, particularly in single-family homes, people taking out fixtures, toilets, you name it. If they do that, and it requires a substantial amount of work and money to put it back into a habitable condition, you can't use that unit, you won't be able to rent it out, you won't be able to generate any income. Therefore, my recommendation to you in this short presentation is that if people are delinquent in assessments to you, they bear watching. If you start to see activity of moving, that sort of thing, keep a careful watch, because it is against ordinance, local ordinance, to make a unit uninhabitable. It probably is also against your documents. Therefore, if necessary, it would be appropriate to call local code enforcement or to bring a quick action seeking an injunction to prevent owners from stripping the units and making them uninhabitable. Okay. Thank you very much.
Next, we'll hear from Buzz Osley.
Thank you, sir, and what a privilege to be here. I work for you, and I always remind myself daily what a privilege that is. You're my countrymen and countrywomen, as I'm yours. And this used to be more of a fun job when we talked with people about how can we afford workforce housing and things like that. But for the last 2.5 years, we've been working on the difficult problem of foreclosures, delinquencies, and all the associated concerns that go with that. I really do need to say that Congressman Posey, your staff has been extremely effective in working with the people that contact us and that we then pass on or that we respond to Congressman Posey's staff. They're not all here, but let me tell you, they're dedicated and they know what they're doing and they're very effective. Everyone in this room has a different mortgage situation than anyone else. So each one of us is unique in a lot of ways, but particularly in our mortgage situation. So every one of you got different concerns, different situations, different anticipations. What I would like to do is this. Let me leave you with my name and try to be a point of contact for you with the next level of detail type questions that you would have for me. So can I just leave you with that and let you know that if I have a contact from you, either I or the people in my office will respond to you and give you the best answer that we know how. And of course, as questions come up, we'll try to answer those today also. Thank you.
Okay, Roy. Good morning. I'm Roy Bush with Consumer Credit Counseling Service, as you know. My agency's been here since 1982. We've been a HUD-certified housing counseling agency since 1993. And I got here, as the congressman said, in 2001. I've never seen anything like what I've seen lately with all the foreclosures, and it's really been overwhelming, but we're working hard to try to help people avoid foreclosure. It's not always the best news when you avoid foreclosure, but try to keep that off the report. I will try to answer all the questions that I can answer today, and if there's time afterward, we can talk, and I've got some cards I'll pass out. We have offices in Melbourne, Rockledge, Titusville, and I don't think anybody would be interested in this one, another one down in Vero. So if you know somebody down there that needs help, you can always refer them to that office. And I look forward to trying to help you answer your questions or emails, because I'll also take some emails and get back to you. And I'm glad to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. Erin?
Good morning, and thank you all for inviting us here today. I'm Erin Zabel. One important topic that I thought would be important for this group, the Florida Supreme Court set forth a task force to make a report on the delays in the foreclosure process and how that's affecting various players within the groups and how better to clear the pipeline, basically, of all the foreclosures that are sitting just waiting, which I think all of us have felt the effects of. They basically divided the groups into three different parts: homestead properties, which they would prefer go into a mediation process before the suit really takes hold. Then the second class is vacant and abandoned properties, which they think an expedited process, which we all agree we want owners in those properties again that will start paying their dues. And then other foreclosure cases, basically where there's tenants occupying the property or they're non-borrower occupied, which they kind of address would be a mediation process of some sort where both parties would have to pay, not just the banks. Currently, the 18th Circuit, Brevard, and Seminole have a similar plan in place, and we're not seeing the numbers of foreclosures decreasing. I think the task force didn't take into account the main delay at the end of the foreclosure process, the sale being delayed over and over again, and generally these are because of the short sales that they start to take place, but they never complete the process, and then they start again and never complete it, and that's where we're seeing the majority of the delays. My focus in the practice is generally collections and the defense of mortgage foreclosure, so I can handle a variety of those questions if you have any. That's a basic summary of the task force recommendations to the courts.
Thanks, Paula.
As Carson said, I'm state representative, Rich Bortman. I represent District 30, which is from Rockledge down through southwest Palm Bay, the Wickham Road corridor, if you will. What wasn't mentioned in my bio is that I am a mortgage banker, have been for 20 years. I served as the president of the Florida Association of Mortgage Brokers for 2 years. As a result, I serve on the Insurance and Banking Committee in Tallahassee. I learned quickly that along with being a state representative and having to pass a balanced budget, I also have to pass condo law every year, because apparently we are a master association in Tallahassee, and I'm sure that riddles you with pain every time we go to session, knowing that something new is coming, and for that I apologize. And I want to tell you a few things. First, I want to apologize. I'm not sure. I have to leave at about 10 o'clock. I have a 10:30, so when you see me get up, please, if you have a question that you wanted me to answer, just email my office, call my office, whether you live in the district or not. I'm happy to help. Many of you, one thing that I understand fully about condominiums is that you are affected by your owners, unlike a residential property that don't share a wall or a floor or a roof. When somebody else doesn't pay their association dues, it affects the entire unit. In the lending industry right now, if more than 20% of your dues are delinquent, no one can get a mortgage in your development. So now they're affecting everybody. And it's a big problem for you, and I know that. And it's a big problem for me as a mortgage originator as well. It's a very unique problem serving, and associations like this are very important so that you can get those problems resolved either legislatively or as a group. I also want to mention what Aaron had talked about. Many of you know your neighbors that have stopped paying the mortgage, and they haven't paid it in a year, and they're not being foreclosed upon, and some people brag on that. They say, hey, I haven't made a mortgage payment in 12 months. That's not because the bank has forgotten about them. We are number two in the nation on foreclosures. We're number one in the nation for delinquencies. 22% of all mortgages in Florida are delinquent in some state. That's a big, big, humongous number. Nevada is second to us, and they're just barely cracking 20%. And then no state is close to Nevada. The reason you're not seeing these people that have lived in their home for so long, and many of you might be in that position, is because banks know that they can only foreclose on so many in a geographic area before they completely bottom the market. There's an inventory of waiting foreclosures, and when the banks are ready, it's going to be fast and swift. So my advice to you for those neighbors that are sitting around thinking, well, maybe they won't foreclose, know that if they're going to negotiate a modification or some kind of redemption, now is the time, because when the bank decides the market can withstand one more foreclosure in your development, it is going to be fast, swift, and painful. The time for negotiation won't be when they get their last pendants. It's now. So the second wave, we haven't seen a drop yet. When we see a drop in foreclosures, just know the next wave is coming. All the ones that haven't been served yet is because a bank knows they're only hurting their own resale value if they flood a market, or in your case, a particular development in foreclosure sales. Does it make sense? Nod with me? Okay. Again, I'm Rich Workman. If I leave before I get to your question, please just contact me anytime. If you want to grab me on the way out, I'll give you my cell phone number. We'll take care of any one-on-one. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm glad to see that Senator Thad Altman has arrived. He is a former county commissioner. He was first elected to the Florida House elected of Representatives, where he served until November 2008, when he was elected to serve in the Florida Senate. Melbourne resident and contractor, Senator Altman currently serves on numerous committees, highlighted by Community Affairs, which oversees most condominium law, and a host of other committees, in addition to being chairman of the Finance and Tax Committee, which affects everybody in this room as well. Senator Altman lives with his wife, Mary Pat, and they have three children, Mackenzie, Hunter, and Sullivan, in Vieira. Senator Altman, would you like to make an open comment for us?
Well, one of my biggest jobs is filling the shoes of Bill Posey, who did a great job representing us. It's a great honor to have us serve you in Senate District 24. I'm a former condo board member. I've been a county commissioner. I've been a state rep. I'm now a state senator. I think the toughest job I had when I was a condo board member. I need to put that in my repertoire of political experiences, because it is a political job, and man, I appreciate all of you guys, what you do, the public service that you give. And it doesn't pay much to be a state senator, $29,000, $30,000 a year, but it pays a lot more than it does to be a condo board member or president. As a result of my experience and I work in the family real estate business, I am really dedicated to your issues. When I was a House member, we only get 6 bill slots in the House of Representatives, but I always reserved 1 bill slot for the condo community. I work very closely with Pete Dunbar, who has done a phenomenal job representing the condo associations throughout the state. Of course, Harry Charles, you just can't say enough nice things about Harry. I always set aside a bill slot, and as a Senate member, I've worked with the real estate section of Florida Bar, and it's an evolving process, as you know, and it's a continuing, non-ending process to refine the state laws that allow those that live in condo associations, homeowner associations, to govern themselves in the best way possible. Secondly, you know, there is diversity of thought and throughout the state, and there's a diversity of issues, and we have to be very careful that we don't allow some pet project or issue that may affect South Florida infuse changes in our law that really is not in the best interest of the public at large. And I want to tell you what, this organization here has made a difference in the state of Florida. It has been a stabilizing factor. I'm very proud to be a part of it in Brevard County because your intellect, your reason has really made a difference in statewide condo law, and it's kept us from really getting into some trouble from time to time.
Thank you, Senator Ullman. Now, we'd hope to stick pretty closely to our foreclosure issues here, but somebody did bring a pre-printed question, so we're going to go ahead and address that right off the bat. And it may have some tie into foreclosures. In our condo association, we have 3 buildings. We are on an 8-year cycle for painting. For one reason or another, the powers to be decided to paint one of the buildings out of sequence for a good price. The treasurer, thinking this was to be a great deal, convinced the rest of the board to go along. An agreement was drawn up to go ahead and paint. The front of the building was painted, period. The board looked at one another and decided to have the rest of the building painted by our maintenance person. He was asked to keep track of materials used and labor expended. Our treasurer paid for the materials out of the reserves funds for the building, but the labor was charged to general maintenance funds for the 3 buildings. The treasurer's thinking is or was that all the painting should be general maintenance so that the money spent for the building in question would be lessened by our general maintenance. Y'all following? In other words, all 3 buildings would pay for the mistake. I expressed my feeling with the president, and he said he agreed with me but did not want to challenge the treasurer as he had too many other issues to fight over. He suggested that I contact Ombudsman in Tallahassee to get a reading on this problem. I contend that painting is one. Paint and labor should be paid out of the reserve fund, which up to now had been done. We are coming up on the end of our paint cycle for the other 2 buildings and want to see these totally paid out of the reserve fund. What does Paul Wien say?
Hi, folks. Actually, there really isn't a right or wrong answer to this question. There is nothing wrong with using your operating expenses, if you have excess operating expenses, to do something that might otherwise be chargeable to a reserve. It is also not impermissible, if you're painting, to use the painting reserve to pay for it. Therefore, it really is within the sound discretion of the board as to how to use that money. So it's not wrong to pay the labor out of the operating fund and pay the supplies out of the reserves. It would not be wrong to pay both out of the reserves, and it would not be wrong to pay both out of the operating account. Now, if you do it out of the operating account, obviously you've had the effect of extending the useful life of the building that's involved, and therefore the reserve can be adjusted so that your annual contributions to that reserve can be reduced. So you will get a better benefit one way or the other. The question is, make sure that the board doesn't overfund the reserve since you've extended the useful life by using part of the money out of the operating account. I hope that answers your question.
That was a thorough answer. I'm glad you're here. Okay, how can a condo rent out a vacant unit that's over 1 year in foreclosure and no end in sight? I'd like to take that one. Aaron?
Well, in this case, it depends on what point you're in the collections process. We generally recommend that if the dues are past due, that and then the association is named within the mortgage foreclosure, that you can go ahead and start the collections process. Because the mortgage foreclosures are taking such an extreme amount of time right now, the lien foreclosure often beats the mortgage foreclosure. There are a lot of factors to take into account with this, though, whether there's renters in the property, because at the beginning of the lien foreclosure action, if there are renters in the property, we can motion the courts for rents and have those rents paid to the court registry. Then, in addition, you want to consider that the association may end up owning the unit. Back to Paul's analysis of whether the unit's being destroyed, you don't want to have to rebuild from the bottom up if you get to the end of the lien foreclosure, of course, beating the mortgage foreclosure, and you have no time to rent because you have to totally rebuild, put in fixtures, paint, et cetera, on the unit, and you're not going to make any money for the association in the end. It's a myriad of factors, but there is the possibility of taking over the unit and renting it before the bank completes their sale. And generally, that's what we're recommending now, given the climate of the extreme length of the mortgage foreclosures going to sale. But like I said, there needs to be a process set forth that you start organizing what factors that you would take into consideration before pursuing the lien foreclosure on these.
Okay. Let me supplement that a couple of things. Number one, the statute 718.116 has this language. If the unit is rented or leased during the pendency of the foreclosure action, meaning the lien foreclosure action, the association is entitled to appointment of a receiver to collect the rent. The expense of the receiver shall be paid by the party that does not prevail in the foreclosure action. So the condition precedent of getting hold of rents is that you must commence a lien foreclosure action. As the representative said, banks are not completing foreclosure. They don't want to hurt themselves in terms of resale value, and I suspect also they don't want to own too many properties for which they become responsible for paying current assessments. Therefore, they are holding a backlog of properties that they will not complete foreclosure on for some time. Thus, even if the bank is proceeding under the current economy, we say, go ahead, start the lien foreclosure action if there's a tenant in there and the property hasn't been trashed, and then move to have, rather than a receiver appointed, have the rent paid to the registry of the court or to the attorney's trust account. So that's a way that you can get it. The other thing that you can do is consider amending your documents. If you already have the ability to screen and approve renters, put in something that says that as a condition of renting and giving approval, that the owner assigns the rent over to the association in the event the owner becomes delinquent. Once that owner then becomes delinquent, you make a demand on the tenant for payment of the rent to the association. You would have the authority to do so in your documents. So we strongly recommend that you consider that kind of an amendment.
Thank you. Great explanation. Is a board bound to include known project cost under $200,000 in the operating budget versus an assessment?
Is the board bound to include known operating costs under 200? Is that what it said? In the well, obviously, you're supposed to estimate all known operating costs in your budget. And so if you intentionally fail to include projects that you know about that you're going to be doing, you will either have to amend the budget to include those, or you would have to specially assess to do it. The question really is this. Is the cost known at the time the budget's being prepared? This is essentially like doing a weather forecast a year in advance. 2 months after you adopt the budget, you may have a project that you did not really know about or didn't think would be necessary to do at the time the budget was being adopted. But if you know about and expect to do a project, you should include it in the operating budget. I think that's the best way of doing it. I will say that I'm aware that some realtors would prefer to have these things paid by special assessment simply because it keeps the annual assessment lower and therefore makes the unit more marketable. And that's a factor that could be considered also.
Okay. Homeowners insurance. The insurance company raised the replacement cost from $127,000 to $150,000 market value, went to $111,000. Rate increased $150 a year. What is being done to get this problem solved?
Let's talk about homeowners insurance in Florida just for a minute, and I don't think that this particular questioner is going to like my answer, and I apologize in advance. Most of your condominiums are insured by Citizens. This is the high risk. Most of our condominiums are insured by Citizens. The last thing you want to ask for, whether you know it or not, is to lower the insurance premiums at Citizens. They are already at least 20% below actuarially sound. And every time when you guys signed up for a policy with Citizens, you've agreed to be assessed in the future if Citizens comes up short. And it won't take much of a storm with a 20% below actuarially sound tables to come up short. And when you get assessed, the way it works is first you get assessed. If that's not enough, then everybody gets assessed. If that's not enough, it keeps going to any kind of insurance policy in Florida until we make up the difference. Basically, Citizens Insurance is a credit card that you all have on reserve as taxpayers. What we need to do is be realistic about our insurance rates and allow Citizens to gradually bring those rates up to actuarially sound tables. So, and legislation that passed last session allows them, I believe, a 10% increase per year until that is met. So you're going to see Citizens Insurance raising their rates to try to get sound. And as much as that's painful in this current economy, and as bitterly debated as it was in Tallahassee to make that change, is either pay now and know the cost of your insurance, or pay later and not know the real cost of your insurance. Because I will tell you that after a hurricane, the last thing you want is also another bill from Citizens for your personal assessment because we were insolvent. So you're going to continue to see your insurance rates slowly increase to try to hit that actuarially sound table, to try to make it so you know the actual cost of your insurance.
Senator Altman, you want to comment?
Well, I can give you a little bit of insight as far as the political dynamic as it relates to Citizens. Obviously, the folks that need Citizens are individuals that live in typically coastal high hazard areas, hurricane-prone areas, basically us. And it's a constant battle. You know, when Senator Posey was a great leader in the insurance issue and really helped avert just catastrophe in our state, financial catastrophe, because we know what would happen to the economic viability of our state if you could not receive insurance. And after Hurricane Andrew in Dade County, we started losing our insurance companies. And if there is an viable private market, if you can't acquire a homeowners association from any private, I mean, if you can't acquire insurance from any private provider, what do you do? And Citizen is a stopgap measure to do that. And of course, we know it's funded. The public funds is funded basically through assessments for other policies such as auto insurance. Senator Posey, now Congressman Posey, could probably give you the minute details. And what we thought in that particular program is inland property owners that that have that are not prone to wind strong events like we are just simply want to write off the rest of the state and say, you know, let them deal with the problem. We don't want to be a part of a larger insurance pool. And that's what Citizen does. A statewide pool helps keep the rates down. I think we produce like 70-80% of the state's wealth right here on the coast. We pay the lion's share of property taxes and sales taxes, and industry seems to want to move here. Tourists want to come here. So we are important to the state. And so we thought to make sure that we also had access to windstorm insurance, both private homeowners, condo associations, business, to keep our economy afloat. A lot of the rate issues that we deal with, it's a constant battle to try to keep that balancing point. So we keep citizens as actuarially sound as possible, but at the same time affordable for our residents. So some of these, I think we were able to keep the rates from going up too much politically, at the same time to stave off efforts to push all the expense, maintaining our exposure only to coastal residents, which I think is unfair. I think it's important we have a larger statewide pool. That's why you have insurance, is you have a large pool to keep our rates down. So I will continue to fight for the people of Brevard, people in our area that are very important, that we are one state, that we are in this together, and that's going to help keep the rates down. And we have seen some adjustments to keep it actually sound, but I think we came out pretty good considering what could have happened in the alternative.
Can I ask you a question?
Let me ask, if I may, our representatives or state representatives. Last year, there was an attempt to revise the condominium insurance provisions of 718, and it didn't pass, but I know it's coming back again this year. As currently written, the Condo Act requires that every owner have a policy on their unit, both property insurance, casualty loss, and also liability. As I understand it, the attempt will be this year to remove that requirement so that there is no requirement that an owner insure either their own property or insure themselves against damage to third parties. I feel very strongly that at least liability insurance ought to be mandatory, and I'm wondering what your position is on this. I mean, the reasoning is that in my practice every single day I have problems where a toilet or a sink or a bathtub overflows and it floods the units downstairs, and everybody looks to the association when there should be some liability on the part of the owner where this generated from. And I'm wondering if you folks would, when this comes up again this year, take a real hard look at it. And while, it may save people money and it may be the politically expedient thing to do, as you said, when you live in a condo, what you do affects other people. And I really think there ought to be a requirement for mandatory liability insurance imposed on every unit owner.
I'll take a stab at it and hand it down to Fed for Senator Altman. I don't think that bill last year came before me in a committee. Apparently, died before it got to me, so I'm not very familiar with it. But judging by the applause, I would say that it sounds like our condo owners would be in agreement with our condo lawyer. Is that right? So an impromptu poll tells me which way I should vote on that.
And that is a very contentious issue, and there's a lot of diversity of thought, and it does vary geographically. I think that the key is that we have liability insurance that's affordable, that we don't place undue burdens. I don't think I've ever met a trial lawyer who didn't like a requirement that everybody have to pay a lot of liability insurance. It's good for the lawsuit industry. We want to prevent that from happening. We do want to prevent an environment that becomes even more litigious than we have today, because we know who pays the bills for that. So I've lived this issue personally, and I think it does make sense to have each unit have some individual liability, but I think it should be limited to ensure that we're not requiring consumers to pay an excessive amount of liability insurance.
Thank you. Can you address mortgage companies not taking title to property so they don't have to pay monthly assessments? Part of the first question. Second question, will this be addressed in Tallahassee? First part of the question, anyone want to address it? Can you address mortgage companies not taking title to a property so they don't have to pay monthly assessments?
From the mortgage side is where I'll answer this question is, it's quite frankly up to the bank whether or not they want to foreclose on a property. They're not getting their income. I understand the burden that it puts on a condominium. I think that the two panelists to my right addressed how we can offset that. Your lien is going to go through the courts much faster. Be careful what you wish for in this particular situation. If you ask Tallahassee to force the foreclosure when it's allowed, typically it's 9 days delinquent, could trigger foreclosure, you're asking possibly to flood your development with active bank-owned foreclosures. If you think you have a value problem now, let two or three more go into receivership at the same time. So banks that are managing that are actually doing you a favor. So I think the answer to the question isn't to mandate banks to foreclose faster. It might be to change the bylaws and to do what Aaron and Paul said earlier and just get your lien through the courts faster so you can become in receivership of that unit to take in the rents. I just want to repeat, be careful what you wish for on this particular instance. You do not need to force banks to foreclose quickly, which means to them, dump them quickly, which means values even more hurt in the long run in your developments. That would be my first thought on that.
Do you want to go? May I ask? Yeah, let me ask you this, because I think there's probably a more pressing issue, and that is, should lenders be required to be responsible for upkeep of the property even before they take title? I mean, because you have a situation where people are in the condo or in the homeowners association, they're not paying assessments, so there's a squeeze on the association. The properties go into disrepair because nobody owns it. It's been abandoned by the owner. Maybe if you're in a single-family home, the pool is turning green, you've got rodents and things like that. The association has less money to go and do something about that upkeep, and if they do the upkeep, they will never recover that money because it will not be paid to them by anybody. So should we not consider in Tallahassee imposing some maintenance burden on a lender, perhaps from the time they commence the foreclosure?
Again, be very, very careful what you ask for. Let's talk through this. As a lender, as a guy that does mortgages, I like to do mortgages on condos. And right now, it's very difficult for me to give you a mortgage in Florida in a condominium. In fact, FHA just came out with new condo guidelines, and it spelled out all these great new rules. And the last line was, except in Florida. So unless you want to move to a cash-only buyer system, put more burden on banks and it will force them not to lend. Condo loans are already more expensive. They're already harder. They require more down payment. There's much more requirements on a condo loan than there are a residential loan. And if banks know that if it does go into foreclosure, they're going to then be responsible for all the maintenance charges, they are not going to lend on condos. And you're going to have a whole bigger problem, i.e. a value problem, trying to sell condos if your only market is a cash buyer. What he said is true. I understand the burden it puts on you. But I think the workaround is another way versus trying to force the banks that will simply stop lending on condos, which they've almost done in Florida already. And you will be very upset when all you're doing is praying for that really rich guy from New York to buy your one of your seven vacant units. Just food for thought.
How about another escrow, tax, insurance,
I'm just questioning whether or not when you buy a unit or a home and you finance it, you typically will set up an escrow for taxes, an escrow for insurance, and that money is held by the lender in the event you don't pay the taxes or in the event you don't buy insurance. How about putting up a third escrow for assessments or for maintenance expenses to the property? That would be money that would be paid by the borrower as part of the mortgage and held by the lender. I'm sure the lenders wouldn't turn down having additional funds in their banks.
the additional funds part, it's against federal law for a bank to make money on an escrow account. So there's no additional incentive for them to hold it. And that would be a federal mandate on banks, and they already count the condo assessments in the principal interest tax and insurance payment. So I don't, that may be a solution. How does that help, though, when the borrower stops paying?
Well, then the bank would presumably have escrowed funds with which it could maintain its own collateral, pay for the maintenance of the collateral that wouldn't have to come out of pocket.
Oh, you mean... excuse us for a minute. So you're talking about an escrow account on top of the standard...
Yes, sir.
You're limiting your buyers. For those of you in the room that own it already, it doesn't matter, but if you want to sell the next one, you're asking somebody that can afford it that needs taxes, principal interest, taxes, insurance, condo dues, and additional escrow account. You're limiting your buyer market. I really like very much what Aaron said more, or I think it might have been Paul, to go take a hard look at how you go about suing for the rights to rent that unit and be strong on that end, because I think that when this foreclosure bottoms out and we begin to return to a market, if we have changed the law that makes it much more difficult for someone to buy a condo because of price, because of payment, because of escrow burden on the banks, additional cost on the banks, when the market can return, you'll see it won't return because you have limited your buyers to a very small market. It's a very dangerous thing. Just...
Usually the reason the lenders require the escrow for taxes and insurance historically has been they came due at different times certain during the year, and there was occasions where people would not set aside that money to make that payment. Your assessments, your condo fees should be payable every month. If you don't make that to your association for whatever reason, in all probability you wouldn't make it to an escrow account either. And I don't think if I told all of you, now you need to start sending your escrow account to a middleman to hand it over to your condo board, you'd be very pleased with me at the end of the day. So it's a case of more regulation, more cost, and the bigger fight right now is the lending industry would like to get a waiver on its liability for foreclosing on units. They wanted, I think, the last time it went to the committee when I was in the State Senate, they wanted a 3-month limit that they would only be responsible for 3 months of condo associations in arrears. The legislature wisely refused to give them that, and that's one of the reasons that they haven't foreclosed yet on a lot of properties. And there's an upside to it, and there's a downside to it. You've heard both sides of that. Next question. What effect does bankruptcy play on the lien and foreclosure process?
Well, when the bankruptcy is filed, the lien and the mortgage foreclosure are going to be halted. At that point, we can't move at all. This is at any point. This could be at the beginning. It could be at the end when we're a day away from the sale. We have to wait at that point until the bankruptcy is discharged or dismissed to proceed on the lien foreclosure. That doesn't mean that with the lien on the property, it doesn't mean that the assessments are wiped out. Those assessments can still be collected. The lien foreclosure or the mortgage foreclosure can still move forward once we get that discharge or the dismissal on the bankruptcy, because those assessments are attached to the property at that point. Only the amounts, the personal money judgment against the owner would be dismissed in that case.
Thank you. Do we, the board, have the right to inspect the unit in foreclosure to make sure it isn't being trashed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Unanimous yeses on that one. Okay. Is there a particular way they would go about that?
No.
Like, what if a guy is in a unit being foreclosed on?
and they want to come look at it, and the guy said, you come to my house, I'm going to shoot you into the castle doctrine. What do you do?
What say you?
718.111 subparagraph 5 says that, and a lot of documents mimic this, says that every association has an irrevocable right of access to the unit. So what you do in that situation is you hire an off-duty police officer to attend your entry along with a locksmith. You give advance notice to the owner of when you intend to be there, and hopefully he won't use the castle doctrine, because this is an exception to the castle doctrine. But make sure if there's a threat like that, that you do have an off-duty officer there and a locksmith.
Good answer. Good, Patrick. I'll just ask Paul. Thank you. Can the board discuss owner delinquencies and how they want to move forward using owner names and unit numbers? Can these be named in the minutes? Can these be listed on the meeting agenda? And I assume they're worried about the liability.
That's interesting.
Yes, you can discuss it. Do you want to list them as some sort of a public thing? No, you don't want to do that. But and I would not even recommend using names. Why create a potential to have liability for violation of financial privacy laws? I don't think that really helps a lot. So you don't want to create some sort of a defense or offset by doing it. You certainly have a right to discuss delinquencies. If people wish to see the delinquency list, they have a right to do that. But there are federal and state laws that deal with privacy and the disclosure of a debt to somebody who's not reasonably responsible for it, or somebody who is not involved in it, like a tenant living on the property, would potentially be a violation of both federal and state law. So therefore, don't do it. Okay. One thing that we should do, by the way, in terms of legislation to assist all of you, and I've gotten a couple of pieces of applause. Let's see if this one does. We need to amend the Condo Act to provide you with an additional remedy. If someone is delinquent and you have a bulk cable contract, you should be able to terminate the cable until they bring current. Anybody disagree? Anybody agree?
Yeah.
Our condo association is mailing our proposed 2010 budget along with the notice of the meeting to adopt it per the 14-day requirement. Can we also include a revision proposal to our rules regarding collection of or non-payment of late payment of the maintenance fees?
Do you have a question?
Sure, please. Yeah, the answer is clearly you can adopt a collection policy, and in fact, we encourage you to do that. But be careful that your policy doesn't conflict with either what's in the declaration or what's in the statute. You know, there's a priority of documents, and a collections policy is really nothing more than a rule. So you're telling people essentially in your collections policy how you will go about collecting. We might give you one notice, and we might give it to you after you're so many days delinquent, and then after that we will send it off, send you a notice of intent to lien. You can change that, but you can't do things like changing the interest rate, the date of delinquency, without, for example, amending your declaration. So be careful that your policy, whatever it is, doesn't conflict with the superior authority.
It's good to have a lawyer with us today. Two lawyers with us today, isn't it? It probably cost you all a lot of money if we had to find that out individually, how we do some of this stuff. Harry, this is getting recorded. Would members be able to get copies of this if they needed it? I have access. Good. Good. If I was on a board, I'd want to have access to some of this stuff to refresh it even in more detail. Our condo association did not hold meetings for 5 months. However, the president did communicate to all the board members by sending email, talking to our lawyer, the association lawyers, at a recent SCCA meeting. He said that this sort of communication was against the state sunshine law. This was being brought up at a condo meeting, and the president disagreed and has continued this practice. Is this form of communication legal in place of meeting under the sunshine laws?
Sorry. Okay, a couple of things about this. First of all, this is not a violation of the state sunshine law. The government in sunshine law applies to governments. Condominium associations are not governments. Therefore, that law is completely inapplicable. The law that is applicable is the Condominium Act, and it says that decisions are to be made at duly noticed meetings. Therefore, what you've described, if decisions are being made by email outside of meetings, is a violation of the Condominium Act. Now, emails are permissible to be used for things like discussion, informing, persuading, suggesting, brainstorming, but the one thing you don't use email for is deciding. Okay, the decision-making process is to be done in an open meeting, duly noticed, where the members have a right to attend, speak on the agenda items, and to observe the decision-making process. Therefore, if this board is making decisions and allowing actions to be done via email, they are violating the consumer protections of the Florida Condominium Act.
I just want to give you a heads up that I'll be here for one more question, and then I have to leave, and I apologize in advance for that. Just so in case you check your watch, it's 10 o'clock. But again, please feel free to contact me, email, phone, Pony Express.
Well, since you're going to have to leave, we'll let you do the next question, and we'll let Senator Altman do the... Okay.
Thank you, and I just want to... Representative Wilkins does a fantastic job. It's a great honor working with him. He's a great advocate. On the sunshine question, I know that condo law is a separate section, but in the public record, sunshine law related to public officials, it's been case law that's determined. It pretty much says something similar. Official action would be taken and made in publicly noticed meetings. But through some case law and interpretation by the Attorney General of what that means, they have interpreted any communication, any discussion is a part of this decision-making process. So the standard that we live under is pretty much evolved in defining decision-making as included in the process by which you come about a decision. I'm curious, is there any potential or is there any protection in law the condo association board members can be prevented from some sort of action or lawsuit or attorney general opinion or whatever to interpret it in the way they have interpreted it for public elected officials?
Thank you. It depends in a sense. The emails, if they are transmitted between, for example, the association's office, those are official records of the association. And so we counsel our members to always copy, for example, the manager or the association office, and those emails should be printed out and kept as official records, which are available for inspection and copying by the owners under the Florida Condominium Act. However, the division, the arbitration section, has ruled that emails that are sent to your personal computer are not official records of the association. So that is one reason we want you to copy anything that you send between home computers to the association if it relates to association business. But those records, according to the division, are not official records.
Yeah, question for Representative Wortman before he leaves. What is your long-term view of the legislative situation and when things might stabilize?
I think the state obviously is crunching numbers because, you know, we're a state that's based on home sales and growth and sales tax, so we're always crunching numbers because we have to make sure that as a balanced budget state, we're not going to spend money we don't have. And I just recently asked for the numbers on the real estate industry, so I'll give you some of those ideas. As all of you know, condo sales are hurting every bit as bad as residential sales, and in many markets much worse. The flood of condos has caused that. The official expectation, let me start with this, for the first time in recorded history, Florida has had a decrease in population over this past year. 58,000 residents left, exceeding the birth rate of Florida by 58,000. So we need growth to be sustainable. The state does believe that the current drop in population is temporary based on the fact that home prices are again 17% below the national average. Before the boom, we were 20% below the national average. We had a boom and went 20% above the national average. We have receded down to 17% below. Now, that stinks for many of us that are upside down in our condos, but that is great for resale. And so we are currently having what we call traditional buyers return to the market. These traditional buyers are not necessarily just the investors. These are the people that have bought and sold time and time again. They have no problem doing a mortgage. They're not the first-time home buyers. They're not the empty nesters that haven't bought or sold in 30 years. The traditional buyers move every 5 years or so. Okay, they've returned currently. And they've flattened the market. But for the first time in recent history, they're still competing with foreclosures and short sales. So whereas a traditional buyer was used to moving in and having instant equity, they find themselves moving in and competing with a lower price short sale of the exact home or condo next door. So instead of picking the phone and calling their grandkids and their friends and their neighbors saying what a great time it is to buy in Florida, they're keeping it quiet. So we're having a much longer return to the market than we'd hoped. And the official numbers are that we expect to see a return in third quarter of next year, 2010, and then a return to normalcy third quarter 2012. So we want to see an increase in the sales by third quarter of next year, and that's a result purely of getting through the short sale boom. We all talk about foreclosure boom. There is a boom in foreclosure in short sales as well. Florida is one of only four states. Listen to this. We are one of four states that have more third-party sales than straight residential sales. That means there are more sales in Florida being handled by banks, i.e. short sales and or foreclosures, than there are buyers and sellers. And it's by a long shot. Until that changes, until we see more straight sales, we will continue to at best be bottoming out. That means you're going to read before today, next month, maybe that sales prices went up, then down, then up, then down. It's just going to bottom out and be a flat line for probably another year before we see a bell curve up. Unless we have a really, really wet, sleet-filled New York winter. So that's your prayer. Your prayer is not that I wish my value would return, because that doesn't happen unless a lot of sleet falls on the Big Apple. Thank you all very much for having me.
Thank you, Connor, Representative Workman, and I must say that Senator Altman and Representative Workman are doing an outstanding job of trying to make the best of this recession that we're in, to put it mildly, on the state perspective. I mean, they have fought raising taxes. They have fought getting rid or reducing the most valuable programs. And from my perspective, the lawmakers in my state lead the nation in dealing with this because they had done some pre-planning. We still have a rainy day fund that they have not plundered yet. And I'm just real proud of the way that you guys have managed that on the state perspective. On the federal level, I'm not as optimistic. Sorry, but, you know. You know, people right now in this economy, the banks have money, but they're not lending it to anybody. You all have money to buy a new car if you want one, but you're not buying them. people north have money to come down and take a vacation and replenish our coffers, our tax coffers down here, but they're not taking them. Why? Because they're afraid of what's next. They may be retired and not worried about their job, but they're worried about when the guy that's in the unit next to them loses his job, then that affects their values and everything tumbles down. What Congress is doing, I'm afraid, is going in the opposite direction. We know what we need to turn the economy around is what? Jobs. Jobs. They said, pass a stimulus bill, Secretary of the Treasury turned the guy, pass a stimulus bill, and unemployment will never go above 8%. So they got him to pass a $1 trillion stimulus bill and the credit cards your grandkids, and it's past 10%. And Geithner's asked, well, what about this? He said, well, it's right on schedule. No, your chart says it's going up to 8 and down. That's what you're saying. He said, well, everybody knows it's got to get worse before it gets better. Yeah, we know that, but you said 8%. Now, and nobody knows where it's going to stop. The cap and trade bill that was passed by Congress that is stalled over in the Senate right now will cost another 5 million jobs. The health care bill that's passed the Congress and is sitting over in the Senate right now will cost another 2.5 million jobs. So, you know, you think that we would be doing everything we can to put people to work, but the regulations and the add-on stuff, and it's not my estimates of job losses, by the way. These are from the truly nonpartisan. There is a nonpartisan function in Congress, and that's the Congressional Budget Office, CBO. So I think Congress is starting to wake up because a lot of people are really getting angry now about what they're saying, and they want to start seeing a turnaround, and they're getting very vocal about it. So I think that it will probably be getting back on track a little bit pretty soon. And I think when it gets back on track, when people feel comfortable that this is not the end of the world, that people are not going to be starving in the streets because the government truly has a recovery plan. You know, so far, there's not been a recovery plan. I asked Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, I said, what is your recovery plan? You know, even if somebody takes a vacation, they'd have a roadmap. You know, they'd have to have a game plan. So we got a 5-point plan, stimulus, which didn't work. TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, didn't work. We're going to do TALF, hopefully, which won't work. More regulation. And mediation, which meant mortgage cram down, which mortgage brokers here, if you allow a judge to unilaterally reset people's mortgage amount and their interest rate, nobody will ever make another loan to anybody, so nobody's ever going to buy anything if they have cash, so it's going to kind of hurt the market. But I'm pleased to let you know that 3 weeks ago, I believe, the president appointed a blue ribbon committee of 31 people to come up with a recovery plan. So hopefully pretty soon we will actually have a recovery plan. And that's the first step to getting people's confidence back, is having a plan that they can see. We can see the progress. They can know where it's going. And then you'll have a measure of success. The government, the federal government, has been handling it on what I call crisis du jour. You know, what is today's crisis? What do we think we can throw at it to fix it? But I believe very soon, hopefully, there will be a solid plan in place that will be transparent enough for the public to see and be able to determine if we're getting back on track. And once this thing starts going, I think everybody will be on board with it when we get the confidence. They won't be afraid to buy a car when they see that it's moving in the right direction. Right now, we just see it getting worse. And I don't want to belabor that point, but I want to give you an honest opinion since somebody asked us that question. Most requirements that apply to condos, 718, also apply to co-ops, 719. Please clarify this. Thanks.
Well, they don't actually all apply. Co-ops are the stepchild of the association industry. Most people tend to focus on condominiums, and there's been a tremendous change in HOAs. But when you have to do the bill, some people sometimes forget to translate some of those changes into the Co-op Act. So a lot of things that have been done in the condo bill have not been translated to co-ops. In principle, there's really very little reason why they shouldn't be treated almost identically, but the laws are not the same, as they are not identical between condos and HOAs. So a lot of times things are tried out in the condo context because they'll have a bigger impact, and then after the fact they're brought into co-ops. Simply put, there aren't a lot of co-ops throughout the state. There are some concentrated in some areas of the state, like around here, but not a lot in other areas. Certainly no co-ops very much down in South Florida, so you don't see a lot of that legislation being translated. And it will take somebody to just take those changes that they're making in their bill, put the same things into 719, and then have the legislature pass it and the governor to sign it in order for those changes to become incorporated. Frankly, there's a mixed blessing there, because a lot of the things that are happening in condos are not good. And I'm glad to see those things not being translated to the co-op setting. Some of the things that are good aren't translated, and there's no real reason for that. So they aren't the same. They are treated differently. You must look at your separate statute to see what's in it, and that's what governs your particular type of organization.
Thank you, Paul. My question is, does the board have the right to practice selective enforcement, and do they have the right to refuse you the right to speak at a meeting?
Well, obviously, selective enforcement is not supposed to occur. It really depends on the nature of the selective enforcement as to whether it would constitute a defense. If you are the subject of an enforcement action of a particular type of violation and the association has knowingly been selective about it, then you have a defense to that enforcement action. In terms of your right to speak, the Condominium Act allows every owner the right to speak on each agenda item. Okay, so the answer is no, you can't be disallowed the right to speak, although obviously you have to behave yourself. And if you refuse to be polite about it, and I were chairing your meeting, I would do my best to curb your ability to speak. So be polite, be patient, but make sure you get the right to speak on each agenda item.
Thank you, Kim Palm. If a board does not budget for bonuses, do they have the right to give them a Christmas?
Yes.
Where should the money come from?
The answer is yes, they do. As I said earlier, the budget is like a weather forecast a year in advance. And you are doing your best to prognosticate what you are going to spend the money on. But unlike reserves, which the use of which are limited to a specific subject or area, the operating account can be used for any item at all. Therefore, if it turns out that you've spent less on legal fees, God forbid, and you have a few extra dollars, then it is within the sound discretion of the board to award Christmas bonuses.
Condo reserve studies. Has it been mandated by legislators that associations must have a reserve study? How often? Updates.
In not so many words, the answer is yes. What the statute now requires is that, I think it's every 3 years, you must have an engineer review your property and determine what areas are in need of additional maintenance, and that's essentially a reserve study. So not so many words. You aren't required to do a pooled reserve, but you are required to have your facilities checked every 3 years by an engineer and get a written report.
You know, usually when we have these forums, the most questions that are asked are personal questions. How do I stop this or how do I do that? Everybody in here is current on their mortgages, so these poor guys don't have much to say today, so we're going to let them read a few of the questions anyway.
Okay. So let me see if I can get through this. Current Florida statute is hurting condominiums.
We need Florida statute to be changed, thus allowing all monies in arrears to be collected. Entire amount of monthly maintenance and special assessments.
I was reading this card over here. Read it again.
Oh, I'm sorry. Current Florida statutes is hurting condominiums. We need Florida statute to be changed, thus allowing all monies in arrears to be collected. Entire amount of monthly maintenance and special assessments.
You know, we've talked and debated a lot, and of course what the question doesn't get into in terms of what changes do we need to make. And of course, probably the biggest issue we've debated is the ability to put liens in the process in which you put liens on a homeowner's property. And balancing the rights of the individual in the condo association is always a challenge in doing so. And I think this kind of fits also within the liability issue too. I think one of the things that we certainly want to give homeowners association, condo associations the ability to collect unpaid bills and unpaid debt. We certainly want to give them the ability to remedy problems and require as much of a burden. I mean, to require responsible home ownership. But I also think, I think there's always a balancing act to that. When individuals choose to live in a condominium setting or a homeowner setting where we lived in a setting where, I don't want to use the word collective, but probably has other connotations, we also want to be somewhat insured that basic independent American sense of personal freedom is protected as well. So I think we do need to look at ways that we can collect those unpaid debts and fees, but I also know we must be somewhat deliberate in doing that because we don't want to infringe upon an individual's independent liberty and rights, and we want to make sure, and we all know because we've been there, if we've been a part of the process, that just as individuals can act irresponsibly, you can get rogue members in the condo association or homeowners association that much like government does sometimes, impedes upon individual protections of their own liberties and rights. So I think we need to do more, but I believe we need to tread lightly. I believe that we need to be careful that we want to ensure that living in a condo is a pleasant experience and that we have means by which we can resolve disputes without hurting some of the individual rights as too. So I wanted to share that side, and that's kind of where I am on that issue, and I think we're going to have a lot of debate in upcoming sessions on how we give associations the ability to collect these unpaid debts, but also ensure that individuals are protected. Foreclosure issues, unpaid homeowner assessments, damages to the large units, these are all issues. But I also want to talk a little bit about the need to ensure that it's living in a condo will be an enjoyable, independent process, much like it is when you're living maybe in another setting.
This question has to do about communication. The association's board of directors communicates to the owners via a website. Are other methods of giving notice either required or recommended?
Well, this is something I know about because I drafted the current portion of the statute on electronic communication. The only thing that using a website is good, but in terms of notices, and I mean official notices of meetings, what the statute provides is that if an owner wishes and the bylaws of the association provide, the owner may request to receive official notices from the association via some sort of electronic electronic means, whether it's fax, email, or something of that nature. So putting stuff on the website is fine, but that doesn't resolve the association from having to send notice by mail of a membership meeting or notice by mail of a budget meeting and properly posting it in a conspicuous location on the property. Getting something electronically, if you are asking for it and it's permitted by your documents, can be a substitute, but it's not a substitute to simply post it on the website and not send it as well to the rest of the community.
This next is a nightmare. I hope there's not more than one of you affected by this. We have a squatter in a foreclosed unit. We have tried having the sheriff's office and Cape Canaveral Police hand him a vacate the property with no success. We have contacted the marriage office without success. We have sent letters to the lawyer handling the foreclosure and advising him that the squatter is selling the appliances, knocking clothes on the walls, etc., with no success. We have had many calls to the police regarding friends who show up at the complex drunk or stoned. The last one happened last Saturday. We called the police to have the man arrested for trespassing, but the police simply took him to the squatter's place.
Thanks, I really wanted this one. Okay. I mean, I am at a loss to understand the facts here. I don't know how a squatter gets into a property. If you have a means of denying access, then I suggest you use it, whether it's locking a door or something of that nature. But if the person is truly a squatter, they don't have a right to be there. You should be able to trespass them on the property, and they should be required to leave by the police. So I don't know what the police's motivation or rationale is here. I don't know how they're getting into the unit to begin with. If the unit is in foreclosure, frankly, what I would do is if you've got a lien, lien it and go ahead and start the foreclosure process. Now you have the ability to try to recover rent from this person, and that may be enough to motivate this person to move out because they become legally obligated to pay rent. And in theory, if they get an order to pay rent and don't pay it to you and they're in occupancy, they could be held in contempt of court, and that means jail. And so that's something that I would consider doing as well. You know, this is a nightmare. I think you need to talk to somebody specifically about this. My best advice is contact your association attorney, and I hope it isn't me.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. I've learned an awful lot here today. I think I almost know the answer to this one, but I'm not going to attempt it. Units not foreclosed. Now 2 years empty. Condo has a lien against the unit. Can the association get the electric turned on and repair the hot water? Also the heater. Clean up the unit. In other words, the refrigerator has molded food in it.
Well, clearly, if the moldy food you can go in and take care of because you have an irrevocable right of access and you're supposed to take action to protect the condo property, that eventually could have adverse impacts in other units. The mold does transmit through the air. So, yes, you could go in and do that. The unit is abandoned. I take it that you don't have a lien and you haven't foreclosed on it. I would be reluctant to have you making repairs and renting it out until such time as you acquire title to it. Let me just digress for a second because there's been a lot of publicity in this state about people in South Florida and elsewhere who've gotten what they're calling blanket receiverships. And people are misunderstanding this. I've actually had people call me up and say that based on this receivership, they can now take an abandoned unit and put somebody in there and rent it out. That's called a trespass. You don't own the unit. You can't put somebody in there and rent it out. Okay? You need to lien the property, acquire title, then it becomes yours, and you can use it until such time as the lender completes its foreclosure, which at this point may be several years. So I think what you need to do is act quickly on your own lien to get this property. The other reason for not allowing you to rent it out if you don't have an ownership interest is we always counsel our clients, if you own a unit, you foreclose on it, get an insurance policy to protect you from liability if the tenant tenant gets hurt. If you don't own that unit, you don't have an insurable interest and therefore can't get insurance on a unit you don't own. So you can't rent it out. Don't do it.
Personal story, once I was buying a condominium from a bank. This was years ago. And I thought I'd take my wife out to see it. The key didn't fit. Somebody answered the door and said, "Who the hell are you?" "Who are you?" And comes out another third party had rented him the unit. Of course, he didn't own it either. So these things sound bizarre, but they really do happen.
I'm going to read this one. In case the owner is delinquent, in the case, I guess, the owner is delinquent in maintenance fees, can the board of directors send to the renter a letter stating that the lease package will not be sent to the owner and that the renter should check with the owner for more information? Well, maybe it was that.
I'm not sure I understand this. The lease package, I guess the question is the unit rented out at the time? If you have, the statute says if you have the ability to approve leases in advance, then you may deny somebody the right to rent if they are delinquent in assessments. I hope that answers the question. If they've already leased the unit and it's rented out and now they become delinquent, I don't really know what you can do other than file a lien and file suit, and then you can seek to have the rent sequestered. Unless, as I suggested earlier, you consider amending your documents to condition approval of leases on the ability to have the tenant pay you the moment the owner falls into arrears.
Expired. The lease expired.
Okay.
The owner's in there. And the owner is not going to be able to send out another package for a new lease.
Okay, so in this situation we have a lease that's expired, and apparently he's asking for renewal rights. And generally you don't approve renewals of leases. But in your situation, you're saying, fine. Again, what I would do is lien the process, lien and start a foreclosure, and then tell that tenant to pay the rent to us.
Buzz?
Question on exterior. We have a decorative facade made out of concrete. If we replace it with another type of material, but the look is similar, is that considered a material change? It's a material alteration if it substantially and materially changes the form, function, or appearance. So what you're saying is it's the same function, it's a different material, and the appearance is substantially the same. If the cost is not significant and you really can't tell the difference, it's not material or substantial. Therefore, no membership vote is required. I would suggest you talk more specifically with your association attorney to run past him or her what the costs are, et cetera, what this is looking like. May I ask a question, gentlemen from HUD? Could I ask a question about the status of the rewrite of the HUD rules regarding mortgage lending? I mean, one of the things, and I've had clients following this, and there were supposed to be rules that went into effect October 1st, and then they were extended. The question of restrictions, which is a big problem here, because most of the association documents do say, for example, that if you want to sell, you have to write a first refusal, and if you want to lease, you must get approval. And the old HUD rules that were dating back to the early 80s said, essentially, we won't lend to you if your documents have restrictions. What's going to happen with that?
We just happen to have somebody here from HUD today.
Two things. First, when Rich Workman made the point that the that there was a the last paragraph in all of the proposed FHA condominium new rules excluded Florida. It excluded Florida only because only to the extent that, that anything that has to do with condominium approval of condominium developments will be looked at specifically by the Atlanta Home Ownership Center and approved there rather than being approved by designated lenders. It's that's just a reflection of what we've been talking about all morning, and that is the condition of the condominium properties in Florida. You all are directly involved in it, but not to the extent that for perhaps Miami is and some of the other. You ask about the right of first refusal. The right of first refusal will apparently be waived unless it has something, as long as it does not have anything specifically to do with the violation of fair housing.
Okay. So that will make that will have the effect of making more money available to properties here who have that right of first refusal.
That is really more of the core question, Paul, and that is that maybe just a moment here about where is FHA coming from on this? What would FHA's probable and reason be? There's reasons for restrictions and there's reasons for their functions here. The reason that FHA, as I understand it, the reason that FHA is taking a hard look at the condominium mortgage market is that FHA insures lenders against foreclosure loss. So as FHA underwrites those loans and makes an insurance decision, what they want to do is try to encourage a recovery of the real estate market. 2.5 years ago, almost today, I met with a group of mortgage bankers and asked them, why do you only do 3% of your mortgage business with FHA insured loans? They said, well, it's too strict to take all that paperwork. People actually have to document the fact that they have a job. They have to you don't have to be a mortgage expert to know what these terms mean. What about a no document loan? What about a stated income loan? Those are the bad loans that are they're all gone now. Those are the loans where most of the people who were part of those loans have had the predictable problems that came from them. Loans that aren't underwritten any more than having someone just say, this is how much money I make, or don't trouble me with the documents. That's why it was so easy then. It moved so quickly. But now we're back to where FHA has about 30% of the market, and FHA will be to FHA-insured loans. Remember, FHA doesn't make the loans, they just insure the lender. FHA is going to be a very important part of the recovery, and already is to a great extent, where FHA is insuring about 30% of the loans that are being made in the marketplace. There is a very interesting dynamic going on in which FHA has looked at its nationwide experience in the loans claims that it pays out, and because FHA never really made any of the crazy loans, the foreclosures that FHA is paying claims on are foreclosures that come primarily from job loss. Almost a 5-to-1 ratio of reduction in borrower income because FHA loans were pretty well underwritten, solid. They were almost a standard for the industry. But as this goes forward, and FHA proposed some initial rules that they thought were prudent, it turned out that they not only were prudent, but perhaps they were stricter than they needed to be to fit the dynamics of the mortgage market without FHA coming back to be a subprime lender insurer. So the Mortgage Bankers Association, the National Association of Realtors, and others involved, including condominium associations and homeowners, all were in
invited and became involved in the decisions as this, as these restrictions move back and forth, and as they settle down, Paul, into those restrictions and those new regulations that affect condominium lending, they've been put off now to take full effect. I believe the latest date is February. And because that amount of time has yet to pass, I think there'll be a lot more of a dynamic as this goes forward.
Will that also apply to manufactured homes that are condos? I know there was a change in the law as part of the Recovery Act to free up some mortgage money for manufactured housing. And manufactured condos, will they be subject to the same rules?
That's my repeated question. Oh, the question was, there are, with respect to manufactured housing condominium associations, which until fairly recently were not insurable by FHA, are now insurable by FHA, and also almost specifically in response to Florida and a couple of other states, the maximum insured loan limit has gone up to over $400,000 for manufactured homes. So yes, those we can expect that the that any of the condominium regulations that affect manufactured housing, unless there's some unusually unique aspect to it, would be included in those.
Regarding collection of assessment and fees, why do banks in a unit foreclosure only have to pay 6 months of the amount that is in arrears? Can the legislature change this to make all collectible, all arrears collectible? I'm going to have to ask Paul. I would assume yes, unless there's some federal law that prohibits that. And if we can do it, I would be for it. I mean, the condo association is not making these loans.
Senator, last year there were a number of bills that would have done just that, and not one of them got out of committee. Not one of them. The statute, Condominium Act, says that the lender, first mortgagee who forecloses or takes a deed in lieu, is legally liable for only the lesser of 6 months' assessments or 1% of the original mortgage amount, which is usually the lesser amount. So it might be $300, $400, $500, and that's basically it. There are moves this year that will be coming up to say that if they don't pay that amount within 30 days of taking title, they become liable for the full amount due. In the past, the organizations that I've worked with have tried to dial it up from 1% of the original mortgage amount to 2 or 3%, and frankly, the bankers' lobbies have told us if you attempt that, we'll not only take away the 1%, we'll slap you hard. I mean, they have the ability to do that. They don't want to be liable for all back assessments. I am also admitted to practicing, though I haven't for many years, in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, there is a super priority for the arrearages, and the lenders do have to pay all arrears. But we have had that fought hammer and nail here, and we've never been able to move it up beyond 1% or 6 months. And that's where it is, and simply a matter of state law.
Well, I think you answered both my questions. One, there's no federal prohibition, and I was going to ask what is the status of other states. It would be very interesting to look at that.
They vary all over the place. There's always some percentage. The question is it all of it? And I know, for example, in Massachusetts, it's all of it. Here, it's very little.
Well, I will take a look at that. I certainly would put system in the way.
Looks like a comment here. Condo law, tried to amend it last year, but was vetoed by the governor. Are we going to try again? Too many glitches in the law.
Well, this is a case of those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. About 2006, there was a condo bill, and in that bill was a provision that had the provision to extend retrofitting for life safety from 2014 to 2025. Governor Bush vetoed that bill. That same provision was put in last year's bill, and Governor Crist vetoed that bill. Governor Crist went a little further. He created some sort of tax
task force to determine what the costs of retrofitting are and what the impacts are. From our legislative position, we've told our lobbyist, Travis Moore, don't let that into our bill because it's poison. And frankly, what we saw was that the pipe fitters considered this a jobs issue for them, and they fought very hard to veto anything that would delay retrofitting. So I hope there will be a bill. I hope that some of the things that are glitches will be fixed. But, you know, what happened was exactly a repeat of 2006.
Problem. Many condos are not primary residences. Therefore, mortgage companies are not obligated or as eager to modify loans. Can we, the state or the feds, do something about it?
Let me reread the question so everybody's on board. Many condos are not primary residences, therefore mortgage companies are not obligated or as eager. I think the term mortgage companies means lenders in general, are not obligated or as eager to modify loans. Can we, state feds, do something about it? Probably unlikely. The loan agreement is between a borrower and a lender, and that is a contractual agreement. If the lender if this is an investment property. And this is a little foreign for me because almost all of my concentration has been on individual homeowners in the homes that they live in, their homestead, their residence, where the heaviest concern comes to rest. Those modifications seem to be going forward well. It took a long time, really, for me in relative terms for the lenders to get on board with the loan modification program and the various ways that they respond to owner occupants living in their homestead recovering from job loss or just reduction in income or other circumstances. And those modifications have been pretty effective. Remember, the lenders are, and I think Rich Workman mentioned this, the lenders are in pretty deep just dealing with homeowner occupied properties. There's an understandable tendency for single family residences as well as condominiums that are not owner occupied to be viewed as investor properties in some form or another, and they just have an entirely different category in the lender's thinking. An example would be if someone has an investment condominium in Fort Lauderdale that they thought they would rent for a year or so and then sell it at a substantial profit, and things haven't worked out that way, the lender has less of any interest other than just a financial interest in seeing that loan be modified than it does with being putting its resources and its time with another. So I think it would be unlikely that any laws would be passed or any pressure put on lenders to modify investment properties or rental properties, which are in fact enterprises different than individual homeowner occupied.
Will the FHA guidelines still consider the percentage of units that are absentee owned?
Will the FHA guidelines still consider the percentage of units that are absentee owned? And kind of the answer is yes, Paul, but it's the flip. It's how many units are owner occupied, and that will be that number is 50% owner occupied.
So that will affect the availability of mortgage money also.
So your comment is that will affect the availability of mortgage money on. Remember, the lenders are at the core of this. If you have lenders that are actively seeking the opportunity to make condominium loans, then they will be working with and through FHA and other mortgage insurers to try to come up with a way that can effectively make loans. But the FHA experience has taught FHA that if you have 50% owner occupies and 50% owner occupants in a condominium development, that's a pretty solid landmark and a pretty solid indication that that is a stable, more stable than it would be if there are, say, 80% absentee owners and 20% owner occupants. So the 50% owner occupant standard will continue to apply for condominium approval. And for temporarily, the spot loans are still available, so that, and again, anything that happens in Florida will be underwritten out of the Atlanta office.
Okay, we're getting kind of close, so just to make sure we don't forget before we leave, we again want to thank the Comfort Inn and Dave Spain. This is complimentary. They have been so good to us always. We want to remember to recommend them if we ever have the opportunity, just to show our appreciation. Also, Serb Pro of Southwest Brevard provided the goodies for today. Thank you, Dana Reddington. Where are you? Here she's been back. Thank you, Dana. And again, all of you, as usual, this is the most respectful and courteous audience we ever face. God bless you, and thank you for just being such a great audience and so respectful of our speakers at every forum that we have. Senator Altman.
I want to echo that. I tell you, I compliment this, and it's probably the best collective group of individuals I've worked with in my 15 years experience. The fact that you have open dialogue and you're able to speak about things deliberately and thoughtful, and that's why I think this organization comes to very, very sound conclusions on issues. Plus, what you do, which is so important, the fact that you bring some of the brightest and best legal minds to the table. I can't emphasize that is a great investment, how much I enjoy working with you, because when we approach an issue, we're on good, solid legal ground, and I do appreciate that. I have a question, and I may have to slip out. I have another engagement as well, but I wanted to say a few words of thanks for being here. My question, the question submitted to me is, why is it that Merritt Island is considered a barrier island, yet is not in the wind pool? Probably because we have politicians making these decisions, I guess. I don't know. It's arbitrary, and we've got to get away from arbitrariness, and we moved toward that way with some of the boundary changes in the McCoy. I used to be, and Congressman Posey, correct me, I think it was 15 feet from the ocean, was it? Just a flat-out arbitrary line, and we did change it somewhat. A lot of businesses got caught in that problem. I'm going to look at that. We need to look at that. Something brought to my attention. I used to represent the southern tip of Merritt Island. I don't. I don't represent any beach side except for the Cape. It doesn't preclude me from obviously doing the right thing and fighting for the people of Brevard. But how absurd is that? Especially when you go to the southern tip of Merritt Island, where you literally have a few hundred feet of water separating Merritt Island from Indian Harbor Beach or Satellite Beach. One is in the wind pool and one isn't. So maybe we need to reconsider that, and I will make a personal commitment to do that.
You know, a lot of this stuff is done through the amendatory process. When some piece of legislation that comes up that has anything to do with that,
lawmakers will try and file amendments in Florida, not in Congress, but in Florida. They have to be germane. They have to be relevant or it's out of order. And it was a big fight when they were doing that zone to get the port in, to include the port, because it was they deemed to be more than 20 feet away from the shoreline. And that was the first stretch when that was first passed. They said, hey, this is just a start. We'll come back and we'll look at this again. But then more important issues always seem to preclude that from happening as they go year to year. So the lines have not been amended as we were promised that they would be. And they should be amended based upon a conclusive study, not just the opinion of the day, as it might be. We're finally wrapping up here. I want to thank our panel again for taking the time to go in. These are all the questions that the panel answered. It's hard to imagine. It's a big stack like that. I want to thank you for asking the good questions. We have just a few questions left that we ran out of time that we won't have time to address. If you have emails on here, somebody should respond to those. I'm sure that Roger will get them to them, or Harry, somebody will make sure that they get those. So again, I want to thank all our panelists. We have some cards here from Consumer Credit Counseling Service. If you do know people who are in trouble or having trouble making their mortgage, this is a place to get them started in getting that resolved. The less foreclosures in your building, obviously, the better off everybody's going to be, or the less foreclosures in your community. I know I got a couple of these cards because I bump into people every day that want that service, and the normal line is getting longer and longer by the day, quite frankly. So, again, thank you for your attendance. Thank you for your good questions. Harry and Roger, thank you for your leadership. Thank you all for your courtesy.
On behalf of STCA, I would like to thank all the distinguished panel for coming today, and I hope they gave us enough answers and maybe brought up a couple of extra questions for you. I have a card that somebody would like to have the email addresses for the panel. I will take the emails. I will send out an email to all the associations. I will also have the list posted on our website so that you can have the emails readily available to yourself. Okay, I want to thank you all for coming. We have our next meeting, which will be December 5th. We have the DBPR coming in, Chuck Drago. It will be a very informative meeting. Hope to see you then. Thank you for coming, and thank you for being so respectful. Have a great weekend.